accession number 18202, real one.
Mr. Fowles, real one, where were you born, please?
In London.
Which year was this?
1924.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in London?
Yes, largely. Largely, yes.
Which part of London did you grow up in?
Well, I was born in Dalston, which is now part of Hackney, I think. And my secondary education was at the Central Foundation School, which was more popularly known as Cowper or Cooper Street in the city.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
Well, I must have been, yes, just about 16, because war had broken out in 39, of course, and when I reached 16 in January, the father said, well, if you're not going to go back to school, which I thought I was too big for, you understand, he said, you better find yourself a job, and that's what I did.
Doing what?
Well, I went to an agency up in the city on London Wall and was sent to a firm of hide and skin brokers in the leather colony in Bermondsey, just by Guy's Hospital. And I really spent the rest of my working life there, apart from the Air Force interim.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I did indeed.
Under what circumstances?
Well, as a scout at that stage, we were, as far as I can remember, we were all grouped outside the town hall in Hackney. I don't know if it's still there. And I remember that almost immediately Neville Chamberlain said, we are now at war with Germany. There was an air raid alarm, and that was the famous aircraft that was supposed to have been sighted off the Dover coast there.
And how did you feel when you heard that Britain was at war with Germany?
A little bit scared, but rather excited. You know, I mean, we obviously didn't know anything about war, not at first hand.
Were you in any early bombing of England by the German Air Force?
Yes, indeed. I was in London right the way through the Blitz because I was working at that time. Wasn't old enough for the Air Force, and so I went right through that. We also did quite a lot of scout work, and one of our little duties was to report to the police station in Clapton, and one of our jobs there, we would be sent out, and this was at the tender age of 16 or so, to locate reported unexploded bombs, and a lot of these were on Hackney Marsh. And when I look back, it was pretty fraught, and really they shouldn't have been doing that with young people, but it was quite exciting.
What exactly did you personally find?
Well, one used to have to look for little softenings and little flutings into the ground, because most of the ground at that stage on Hackney Marsh was very low and therefore very soft. I believe it's all been filled in now. But,
did you find many?
I personally only ever saw one, which I reported. I assumed it was an unexploded bomb, but when I had done my tour of duty and went back, then of course it was noted in the book, and that's the last I ever heard of it. So whether it was found and exploded, I don't know. But of course they used to take unexploded bombs that the army had located in the city, particularly to Hackney Marsh, to be detonated.
And would you have a stint of some particular length of time?
I can't really remember, but we used to stay in the station overnight, so that we were always on the hand. The only other duties, actually, in the scouts in those days, we used to go around collecting lots of newspapers and things like this, and we had a good deal of so-called training or instruction anyway, and things like poison gases and things which it was felt might be used. These were the early days of the war. And the only other thing I can really remember about the Blitz was that on a couple of occasions bombs landed locally, and one in particular I remember about 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, and it was at a local church. I just forget the name of the church now, but it was in Dalston, and I was a bit taken aback when I found that the bundle that was a good way from the church but still in the grounds and had not obviously been noticed by anyone else was the curate, the headless curate. That rather shook me, actually, and I started to realise, you know, just what all this war business was about then.
Did you know him?
No, I didn't, actually. It wasn't our church.
Which month might that have been, do you think?
I would say that would have been, you see, the Blitz actually didn't start, as you know, proper until later on in 40. It might have been late 40. It's more likely, I think, to have been the early part of possibly the spring of 41, because I know the weather was very good, the sun was shining, and suddenly these bombs were dropped in the middle of the afternoon, which hadn't been expected.
What was this gas training that you mentioned?
Oh, this was, I think it was really part of the National Service badge that the scouts brought out. They'd had one in the First World War, and this one was a similar thing. It was a red badge with gold NS each side of the scout badge. I've probably still got one somewhere about the house, but I can't think where now. And we used to have to do all sorts of things, be ready to assist wardens and know about gases, have extra first aid training and all this sort of thing, and then we qualified for this National Service thing, which we were quite proud, actually.
And was it something that all scouts were required to do?
They were expected to do it, but they didn't all they didn't all qualify for this badge. As far as I remember, there was we had quite an exam, and we had to have all these duties sort of logged or vouched for by people and so forth. And I believe the police did quite a bit for us. They said, oh, yes, well, this chap Fowles, yes, he used to come along quite regularly, overnight duty at the police station. But, I mean, it wasn't terribly important, but as I remember it, it seemed to be quite important to you know, a young lad who wanted to do something in the war. Oh, yes, there is one thing I'd forgotten, incidentally. The scouts provided an intelligence and guide section in the local, those days, LDV, before it became the Home Guard. It was the local defence volunteers. And we had, we literally did do drill with poles and broomsticks until we got, I'm not sure when it was, I suppose later on in 41, they shipped a lot of these long Lee Enfields from the First World War over from the States. I think they called them P-17s, and then of course we were armed. But the scouts were supposed to know the district, and that's why they became guides and so-called intelligence. I didn't think we were very intelligent, but I did actually rise to the dizzy heights of corporal in that section. And we were the 8th City of London Royal Fusiliers. Amazing what you do remember when you start talking.
What kind of training did you get with the LDV?
That's a bit more difficult to answer. I can remember going on various courses, but they were known, I think, as cadre courses. I'm not quite sure why, but certainly you had to do these courses if you started getting a stripe or two stripes. And there was one that I particularly remember, because it may not have been recorded anywhere else, but there was a certain Colonel Blacker, B-L-A-C-K-A-R, who apparently designed and invented what was known as the Blacker Bombard. This was a sort of a a mortar, but with a spigot inside it. And I remember going on this course out at Woodford, it's in North London, which it was a boys' school there, I forget the name of the boys' school, but we had to go quite a few weekends, and we eventually finished up firing this thing. It was very frightening, it was a huge bang, and we had to take all sorts of precautions, and I did hear later on that they'd had several accidents with the thing, and it wasn't considered to be a very good weapon for the troops. That's probably why very few, if anyone, has heard about it. But that was the Blacker Bombard.
Precautions against being deafened, you mean?
I think more possible, you know, the thing itself actually blowing up, which, of course, any mortar can do, you know. And we were all expendable if we were sufficiently keen enough to join the LDV or the Home Guard. Well, then we had to take our chances at what age we were. And probably by this time, you see, I was getting to about 17 or so, 17 and a half. And when I got to 18, I said to my boss, who was working and living in Liverpool that time, coming down to London, I said, you know, I very much like to volunteer, and I particularly want to volunteer for the Air Force. My father was in the RFC in the First World War, and I'd very much like to volunteer for aircrew, but I was sufficiently, I feel anyway, sensible to realise that if I just said to him, well, I'm going off to volunteer, it might have been goodbye forever. And he said, well, they don't need you, we need you here and what we're doing for the war effort. My answer to that was, well, one or two friends of mine who are waiting to go into the Air Force or have gone into it have had deferred service, and I believe it's running at close on a year now, so that if I volunteer and am accepted for aircrew, then I shall probably be sent back to you, City Street, for anything up to a year. This seemed to him to be very good sound common sense, and I got what I wanted, and it did actually work out. I think it was about 11 months or so before I got out of civvies. We had a little silver VR badge which was we wore on our lapels, and that was it. And finally, I think I can't really remember now what it was in 42 that I volunteered. I think round about the summertime, June or July, as I was just over 18, and then I had to wait. Let me see, I think we went in either the June or July of the following year, so I didn't actually get into uniform until the middle of 1943.
Before we go on to the RAF, if I can just come back to the Blitz period, if the enemy had invaded in 40 or 41, what kind of account of themselves do you think the local LDV would have given of themselves?
I think personally that we'd have all tried very hard, and I think most of the people in the battalion were very very dedicated to it. We had several foreigners, refugees, who were allowed in, mainly as interpreters, things like this. I don't know how they would have behaved. They may well have been braver than the British, because, I mean, they'd seen some of it in Europe and or heard about it. But I think that if the Germans had invaded and established a workable bridgehead, it would not have been long before people like us with old P-17 Longley Enfield rifles would have been just steamrolled. I can't help but feel that, because none of the Home Guard that I saw had anything much more than these rifles. We used to go down to Bisley to shoot, and there we, wonder of wonders, we were given the present, at that time, Army rifle. That was the Shortley Enfield, which I seem to be able to shoot a great deal better with than the American ones. Something to do with the backsight. But again, I think that the fact that LDV was in the LDV Home Guard was in being must have given Hitler and his boys a bit to think about. I think they must have taken it into account.
Had you expected a German invasion at that time?
I couldn't really bring myself to feel that they would get that far, but in the light of events, they were, as you know, extremely close to it. And I can remember being extremely worried when early on, it would have been in 40, I forget the names of the, you know, some of our capital ships, you know, warships. Forget the, you can probably think of them.
Royal Oak.
And things like this. But early on, I think there was another one before that, was sunk, I think it was an aircraft carrier. I'm not sure if it wasn't the Ark Royal. It could have been the Courageous, yes. And that worried me very much, because I sort of felt, well, if they're going to be able to do this sort of thing, it won't be long, you know, before they're overrunning the country. It did worry me, yes, I must admit.
Did Dalston get bombed very much?
Yes, a fair amount of damage, because that was all, you say, round north and northeast London, that area. There was quite a lot of damage.
Did any bombs fall near your address?
No. But my father, who we'd dispatched the rest of the family to Leicestershire, the children, the two young children in the family, because I'm one of seven, the two young children in the family and the girls were packed off to Leicestershire, and later on, the older girls also went as a result of my father's insistence. But he stayed behind, and I stayed behind, and we made do. We used to sleep under a nice, solid dining table at nights, you know, in the corner of the room, so that if anything fell on us, we'd stand a chance. And quite often, you would go out next morning and find pieces of, quite large pieces of shrapnel, presumably from anti-aircraft guns, on the sub-roofs and with broken slates and things like this, which didn't really worry anyone, as far as I remember. It was to be expected. Guns used to come round the roads, particularly the main roads, suddenly would pull up, you know, in the middle of the night and start loosing off, and until you got used to that, that was a bit frightening, because it would suddenly start, you see. But how many of these portable things they had, I don't know, but they were certainly around our part of the world.
Did you not use shelters at all?
We had an Anderson shelter in the garden, and we did use this, I remember, in 1940, the autumn, and it was that that decided my father to send the older girls away. But we didn't use it after that. We felt we could stand just as much chance in the house with a good sort of solid thing over us, you know. It might have been the wrong thing, but that's what the old man wanted, and he'd been in the First World War, so.
Did you ever use the public shelters?
No. No. As far as I know, there were no public shelters very close to us. One had to go, of course, up to the tube areas, and I suppose there were public shelters around, but we didn't feel that we wanted to leave the house or anything like this. We felt we'd stay there and see it out, and as it happened, I mean, nothing ever really happened to us.
What was your address in the war, in the early part of the war?
That was in, now let me see, I can't remember the number, but it was Graham Road, which ran, it was the connecting road between Dalston and Hackney proper. I don't know whether you want to know anything about Hackney, you probably don't. But it was very, I always found it an extremely interesting place, and I did a project for one of my scout badges on Hackney, and of course they have the old church towers. St John's Church has an old, I suppose it could be pre-Norman tower, which I believe is still standing, and that was built by the Knights Templar. And there was a tremendous guide. I mean, there was quite Hackney was quite a proud place, you know what I mean? It was, they told me eventually when I got back after the war that the place had deteriorated quite a bit, but as far as I was concerned, it was the only place to live because my scout troop was there, our football team was there, and all these things. And to a young chap, you know, this was important.
Is that where the LDV met?
Oh, yes. We, in fact, now, what was his name? Our CO was not a military man, although he dressed very well as a military man. He was later the MP for Southend. Now, I've got a feeling his name was McFadgen or something like that. You might be able to check on that. But he was a very good organiser. He was obviously a businessman. And we all looked up to him. He may not have been a military gent, but we had area people who were still very much military with all sorts of wonderful ribbons, you know, including Russian ribbons. I remember one chap, and I can't remember his name.
Coming back to the bombing, do you remember any other particular streets or buildings that were hit in your area in the Blitz?
No, really, there was... There were no very large buildings about. Our church, actually, later on, I certainly wasn't there then, apparently was damaged by bombs, but they must have been, you know, they weren't actually part of the Blitz proper. I think they must have been on aircraft that jettisoned bombs and things like this, because it must have been certainly after 1943, you see, when that particular place was bombed. Not far from us was, and still is, and I believe is still known as the German Hospital. Well, that was actually built, staffed by German doctors and nurses, but not, of course, during the war. That was interesting. I think they had quite a bit of damage in the grounds of that hospital, but whether the buildings were ever hit, I can't tell you because, well, I just can't remember. But there was a lot of bomb damage around that part of London, you see.
How did your own morale stand up during the bombing?
Well, as I said before, I felt that I was grown up now and that I just wanted to get in on the war. And I knew that I would have to be, you know, not too squeamish. And there used to be frightening moments, but that's, I'm speaking very generally. That's the way it was. I remember being out at the edge of Epping Forest, which you probably know, of course, not far from Loughton, where I used to go and help on weekends with a riding school there in return for riding lessons. I was very keen on horses in those days. And a pal of mine, a scout also, we used to sort of spend our nights in a loose box and then make ourselves useful around the place. And they had a shelter, an Anderson shelter, under some trees, the people who lived in the house. Their name was Bestall, B-E-S-T-A-L-L, I remember that. And this particular Saturday, it would have been in the August-September time, I would think, of 1940, because the Battle of Britain was literally raging in the skies. You know, I mean, the sky was full of vapor trails and contrails and things like this. And I also remember that this was broad daylight, and there were guns going off all over, I suppose, London, certainly around there, and Forest and that. And there was a sort of whirring sound, I remember that very clearly, and thump, something fell about 10 yards from us. And we went to see if we could find it, and that was a piece of shrapnel, must have been a good 12 to 15 inches long. And I remember thinking to myself, well, there, but for the grace of God, you see. Things like that, but these happen to everyone all the time, I think.
How did public morale in general stand up to the bombing, from your observation?
Well, I think it was very good. It was people were definitely a little bit panicky for the first month or two of the war, but when, I believe it was called the phony war, when that's what it turned out to be, people certainly seemed to regain their aplomb, if you like. And it was only when the Blitz started that you used to find quite a few people who were very, very frightened, but usually old people. And they would sort of find all sorts of excuses for going into shelters and so forth, which they were entitled to do. But they wanted to get away from it, and they were very frightened, there's no doubt about it. But I would say that young people were foolhardy enough to brazen it out, as it were. I think the morale on the whole was pretty good.
Did you have any casualties in your own family or relations?
My brother had been in the Navy. He was in the VR before the war. He was in the Navy from day one, but as far as I know, he had no wounds or anything like this, and he served all around the world, you know. Several of my pals and the scouts didn't come back. But again, that wasn't, you know, something where your hands were on. I mean, you just heard that they'd bought it and so forth. One other thing that just occurred to me, I remember we used to see, when we went out to Epping Forest these weekends, you would quite often come across a new clearing, literally, you know, resembling the First World War, where bombs had either been jettisoned or fallen off their targets, and the trees in Epping Forest were, you know, in some cases perhaps 100 yards across, completely devastated, just like a First World War battlefield, you know, with stumps and holes in the ground and earth everywhere. That was interesting because we quite often found these places. There'd be no sign of them now, naturally.
What was the attitude towards the German air crews who were carrying out the bombing?
I think people, it's fair to say people were not at all happy, and I can understand, you know, some of these stories that you read about of the people, particularly out in the country, you know, sort of going along with pitchforks and things. But I don't know whether this is relative at this point. Now, of course, we quite often invite German Luftwaffe people over, you know, wartime Luftwaffe people over here, because there's no doubt about it that